Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, in depth on the healthcare debate we should be having but aren't. For all of the political intrigue around repealing, replacing, and/or fixing Obamacare, here's a serious healthcare discussion that we haven't had. How much are we, individual Americans, willing to pay for the healthcare we use? Think about it this way. When you have a high deductible on your health insurance, you are sharing the cost of your health care. When you pay the $20 copay at your doctor's office, you're sharing the cost of your health care. When your employer takes money out of your paycheck for health insurance, you're sharing the cost of your health care. But Americans often complain about the high deductibles and the rising premiums and the increasing copays. And indeed, a Bankrate.com study found that in the last 12 months, one in four Americans said that someone in their household decided not to seek medical attention because of the cost, which raises the question, what are we willing and able to pay for the health care that we use? Two guests in this conversation, your thoughts are really important to the discussion, too. Does a high deductible or rising premiums make you a more informed, more careful healthcare consumer? Is it fair to pay more for your healthcare if you use it and want to use it more? In other words, how much cost sharing is too much? And maybe you've reached that point in your household. I'd like to hear about your experience with this. I hope you'll join us. 651-227-6000 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. Our guest today, Elizabeth Bradley, is Vassar College president. She's the author of The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. And she's with us today from Poughkeepsie, New York. And Elizabeth, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Renee Critchlow is in the studio with me. She's a physician. She's a University of Minnesota School of Medicine assistant professor. Welcome back to the show. Renee, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be back.
Renee, I thought we'd get some statistical context on what's been happening with cost sharing. So in 2017, health insurers in the exchanges are raising premiums again. And again, this is one of the ways that we cost share, by an average of 25%. The premiums on the private insurance market have risen on average, not as much as that, but have also been going up. Do you have the sense that premiums are part of cost sharing that is encouraging more families to assess how they use health care?
Well, in my experience, what I've come to understand about the way we do health care in this country is we don't actually consider cost sharing when it comes to health care. We consider it when we do illness care. We don't really proactively cost share when it comes to prevention. When it comes to illness, people will pay a lot of money. And unfortunately, people will pay so much money that they'll go bankrupt. So we have the system where it's set up right now with the insurance and the exchanges. The idea is perhaps we can provide a consistent health care, wellness, prevention program for people so that they can stay healthy even if they have chronic illnesses, even if they have multiple chronic illnesses like the people I tend to take care of. But generally, when you think about cost sharing, you think about people talking about catastrophic care.
Right, exactly.
And I've been very fortunate. I've been a doctor in many different situations, urban underserved, rural underserved. And I remember people coming to me and saying, "Doc, how much insurance should I get?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" They're like, "Well, we're getting this catastrophic care, and how much, you know, how much should we have as our deductible?" And I'm like, "I can't really tell you that, because if it's just about prevention, that's one thing. But, you know, I had people that were getting in major accidents and getting $50,000 bills from the hospital and going bankrupt. I had people that would have CHF, congestive heart failure, who would beg me to not hospitalize them while they're in the middle of an exacerbation, because they felt that they'd, you know, they'd lose their family farm, literally. And it was generally because the way that they'd set up insurance was they would only do catastrophic care. And that can be...
And then the cost sharing is almost impossible
with
that.
Yeah, it's actually catastrophic for a reason.
Elizabeth, to what Renee is saying about thinking about how we share the cost of healthcare. Is she right that we're often thinking about it in the worst case scenarios and not on the front end?
It's a great question. What we've seen in the literature is those patients that have high deductibles, very high premiums, perhaps these very high risk pool type policies do tend actually to skimp on the type of care that Renee is exactly saying is most important, the preventive care, the care that actually will keep you well. And then when they end up with something quite tragic, chronic, ongoing, they're not at all prepared for how much they still will have to pay for that. What's most complicated about these high deductible plans, which were designed to try to make us sensitive to not overuse healthcare, individuals tend to underuse when they have that, things that are very basic and very important for avoiding much more catastrophic needs later.
Let me grab a call here from Luke in Victoria. Hi, Luke. Thanks so much for waiting. It sounds like you've got a situation that applies to this discussion.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I understand it from both ends of the spectrum. I myself am in the life insurance and investment arena, so I understand that, that cost is cost. But my wife and I both have Lyme disease, and I've had it at least, I think, since I was 19 years old, and I'm 37 today. And we have about a $10,000 per person out-of-pocket cost because the CDC decided not to recognize chronic Lyme disease, and they estimate 300,000 people get Lyme every year. This is the same board putting out that estimation. So you can imagine the cost of how many decades of people getting Lyme going mistreated or misdiagnosed as something else, as my own story was. And but it's just it's preposterous. It's hard to get ahead or feel comfortable when you've got that kind of money going out to medical expenses just to make yourself try to feel a little better.
So, Luke, I want to make sure I understand that. So you have a chronic condition, as Renee actually brought up here. So you are looking at least $10,000 out of pocket for the care for the Lymes for who knows how long.
Correct. And I get to pay my insurance premiums, and I get to also pay my deductibles and copays when my kids get, you know, their flus and all the normal health stuff. It's quite extravagant.
So when you have to make decisions around what you're paying for this health care, how does that affect the way the rest of your family finances?
It's a buckle down and it's a hope and pray and we just kind of seem to get through it. But, you know, the finances go ebb and flow and in cycles for sure. But the reality is we keep coming back to saying we're hearing some scary stuff that this Lyme disease could turn into MS, could turn into Alzheimer's. I mean, we're at the front end of figuring this thing out. And so we have to get treated. So bottom line, we just don't go on as nice of vacations. We don't. I work a little harder. We just figure it out.
What do you hear in that, Renee?
He speaks the truth for all of the folks with chronic illnesses. It's the choice between paying rent sometimes and buying inhalers. We have patients on oxygen who multiple illnesses who are unable to make the just basic decisions of life based on the fact that the majority of their medications and premiums take up all of a significant amount of their discretionary income. And it's not getting better. That's the worst part about it. With all the continued addressing of the various kinds of health reforms we're looking at, there's just so many different people in the game that are looking at people as customers. And honestly, one of the best things about being a family physician is I get to look at these people as patients, and patients are suffering. The insurance costs are too high. What we charge, we don't even know what we're actually charging. When you look at healthcare costs, when you get a hospital bill based on what they charge and what your insurance pays is totally different. We've talked about cost sharing. The costs are buried everywhere. The fact that a lot of people don't even understand that your employer supplied health insurance is basically a subsidy from the government. because that's tax deductible for your employer.
Right.
So that's $400 billion a year that's given basically as a subsidy to the insurance companies. That's a significant cost that we need to talk about sharing.
But I guess, so Elizabeth, the reason I wanted to do this show is everything Renee is saying about where all the costs are buried and then the ones that we feel more directly is all true. And yet, we do have to share some of the costs of our health care, right? And we know that if, or the idea, I guess, is if you share more of the costs, you'll be a more aware, you know, directed healthcare consumer. Where do we put all this in this discussion?
Yeah, I think the concept that we have to share the cost of medical care may be a little bit misinterpreted at this point. I think what health policymakers usually mean when they say we should be sharing the cost of healthcare is to think of a healthy population as a consequence of an entire society investing in its people through a good medical care system, through good housing, through good food, through all the different determinants of making a population healthy. And we share that as a population if we commit to insuring everybody. We then can really benefit from this sort of classic economic model of insurance where people are willing to pay something for insurance. And if we're all in a pool together, the healthy people are willing to pay something and actually never use it, but they happily pay the premium to feel safe that they do have insurance if they need it. And then that, but the money is available for people who really need it, who are more ill. What happens often in countries, and particularly I think in the U.S., is we have not made a commitment to insure everybody, and we are slowly fragmenting these markets so that people who really need the services, who have chronic illnesses, just like you, Luke, end up being in more and more expensive plans, while people who are healthy actually avoid even getting insurance. And that is not making our society one that really shares the burden of medical care that's desperately needed by a proportion of people, not everybody, but a proportion of people in the country. So it's really, I think, important to think about this issue from the social perspective and our commitments to our communities and our larger society, not as an individual perspective only.
Got it. Call here from Nikki in Plymouth. Hi, Nikki. What's your situation with this?
My husband has a chronic condition that we have to do treatment for. Uh-huh. We have a high deductible health plan. So I am very conscious of what we're spending and how much we do have to pay. The problem is I don't have a good resource. I can't be sitting in the doctor's office and the doctor says, well, we need to send you for an MRI. I can't, you know, research easily, okay, do I go with my provider? Do I find a private MRI place? Like, how much is it going to cost me because my insurance has negotiated different prices, different places. So for me as a consumer, I don't have an easy fix for finding where is my most effective healthcare dollar going to be. You can sort of do it with the pharmacy stuff, and I started to do that with his medications, but even that's a big struggle.
Elizabeth, I think this is an excellent point, because if you want to be more informed and more engaged in the way you use your healthcare, you need more information. It just doesn't seem like it's very accessible.
Mm-hmm. Such an important point. And Nikki, I really commend you for actually putting the time in to ask that such important question. Where is my best healthcare dollar spent? Where is that spent best? Such an important question. So where do we get this information? Complicated, exactly as you said. It's not really built in to the medical care system, and each part of the medical care system and the larger financial systems, your insurance system, et cetera, have a perspective, and very hard to get someone who has a whole perspective. Renee is a family physician who I'm sure she will have good reflections on this. But in those systems across the globe that work very well at this, primary care and family medicine are at the center of the medical care system. They really are the hinge between people in their homes and the actual medical care system that can give the advice, that can have the best interest of the patient in mind, knowing their financial situation. In the U.S., we have not invested that much in our primary care system. If we compare ourselves to our Scandinavian counterparts, we just don't invest as much in that. And I think one of the consequences is exactly what you've said. Where's the holistic information? Someone who could really give me a good idea, given I have to make tough choices, which one should I make? I think primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, social workers, other people who have gone through these experiences are your best bet, but you've identified a weak spot in the U.S. healthcare system.
On Twitter, Dr. Deb Ditburner says, need cost transparency and health literacy. 12% of Americans have the health literacy to calculate their personal healthcare costs. Where would you put that, Renee?
Number one, I know Deb, and she's awesome. She's absolutely right. We're in a situation where we're trying to treat this like any market. And the fact is, people with insurance are often locked into specific places that they're able to go.
Right.
I have patients who I can only send to this facility for this kind of care. And that's not something that you can look up on the internet and say, oh, this is going to be cheaper for you, so go here. But to the extent that we can, we actually do that. One of the things that we're talking about in a fragmented way is actually team-based care. One of the issues we have is we have a sort of a population that has a lot of challenges socially. Basically, when you're in a situation where only 20% of your healthcare outcomes is based on what happens in the doctor's office and everything else is wrapped up in where you live, learn, work, and play, those are the kinds of things that truly affect your total healthcare. And when you talk about health in all policies, it means transportation, it means education and things like that. But we have people who literally, you know, you want to get an MRI, I have to send you to this one particular place because that's the only place that your insurance will pay for. That's not going to be something that you can shop around. And that can be very frustrating for both patients and providers. We want to provide the best care. We want to provide it in an efficient way. When it comes to prescribing medications, one of the things I teach is, if possible, do what a generic that's on a $4 formulary somewhere, so that even if someone does lose their insurance, they'll still be able to continue their chronic medications. You have to think about these things because people, honestly, they get locked into their insurance.
Right.
There's people who will not quit their jobs. I've had patients who are like, I hate my job. My job is killing me and I can't stop it because it's my insurance. And if I stop this job, I won't have the ability to continue to care for my chronic conditions.
Elizabeth, I'm curious about what you take away from a morsel that I came across as I was preparing for the show. In 2014, two-thirds of people who were on the exchanges and were choosing plans on the exchanges chose the lowest or second lowest priced plans in each tier. And in 2015, almost half chose the cheapest plans. Now, I understand that, but I also wonder if the people that are making these choices also understand they're going to get more limited care and probably pay more out of pocket for those plans.
Yeah. Well, I think the point you're making is an important one. It's very hard for anybody to think ahead and really understand in full the complexity of the exchanges and their plans, first of all, is enormous. Second of all, even if we can kind of get through the complexity, it's tough to make those decisions. Put down a lot of money now when you're okay for hoping subsequently you'll be okay. You know, those are tough decisions, and we have study after study. All of us do this. It doesn't matter how educated or where in the country you live or really your profession. It's hard for us to make investments now that subsequently are going to benefit us, and insurance is a little that way.
That's true.
So I think it's interesting that in the beginning, the first year, two-thirds paid for the lowest, and afterwards, a half took the lowest. You do wonder whether some people thought, wow, actually, now that I've seen what I get for this lowest, I've got to actually do a little bit more.
Right.
Not that that's good news, but we just know, and I wanted to pick up on something Renee had said earlier. Again and again, our health policy system treats this as if it's a normal market, like you're just going out to buy a car or a pencil or a television, but you're buying your health. And people are notoriously, it's hard for us to have full information, make, you know, really cost-benefit decisions about something so emotional and so dear to ourselves and really so nuanced. It's not just a simple commodity, a provider and a supplier. It's your actual life and health at stake. And I think there we see we don't quite know how to deal with that in our system.
This is part of our ongoing series of health conversations this morning. And today we're talking about the idea of how much is too much when it comes to sharing the cost of health care. And we're having this discussion in what we, I think, have all agreed this morning is a pretty distorted market and distorted political situation on health care. But when you share the cost of health care, you're paying your deductibles, and we know that they've been going up. Maybe you're co-paying on a hospitalization. We know that's been increasing. I have a number on that. So if you're in a situation, perhaps you do have a chronic condition, someone in your family is going through this, and you see that your cost of paying for treatment for that chronic condition has been steadily rising. What does it mean for you and your family? How do you feel about the split between what you're co-paying for your own health care cost sharing and what the insurer is paying for that? 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. And just a number here on the hospitalizations. I saw that this JAMA study found that patients' out-of-pocket costs for spending time in the hospital, Renee, have gone up 6.5%. That's a lot between 2009 and 2013. So if you're going to be hospitalized, you probably are going to end up spending more of your own money on that as well.
Yeah. And the when you talk about cost sharing, one of the interesting things is, you know, that's the cost that goes to the patient. What's actually being paid after the insurance and after the patient pays is not as much as the hospital actually has been charging. We're in the situation where basically as those costs increase, what happens is the hospitals eat the charges. And this is really dangerous for the small rural hospitals who are basically the safety nets for their entire counties. So you're in a situation where as the costs rise, patients can't afford it. Their insurance is not paying it. Who eats it? It's the local hospitals, which is a very dangerous place because they can't afford to continue to maintain that kind of debt. And they're the economic engines for these rural communities.
Call here from Heather in Anoka. Heather, you want to ask about hospitalizations?
Well, I might have a question that sort of relates to that. I've always been wondering about what happens if the insurance company owns the hospital, because it sort of feels like a rigged game where the consumers don't have any cards. And we kind of used to have laws against monopolies in the olden days. So I'm just wondering how that works, because me as a patient with chronic illness, I'm often asked to coordinate the medical distributors, the providers, the insurers, mm-hmm. try to get everybody to fall into place so that I can get access to medications that are prescribed to me by my doctor. And that system often breaks down. And I just don't see a way out of this without legislation working at the base level of
okay.
the system.
Insurance companies, Renee, owning the hospitals, is something you know anything about?
I would be curious which hospital system you're talking about, because generally you can have situations like Kaiser in the West Coast.
California,
yeah.
Right.
Where there's a system where you buy into it and they have their own hospitals.
Heather, which specifically, what are you talking about?
Well, is Regions Hospital owned by Health Partners?
Don't know. Maybe. So, Elizabeth, do you have a thought on this?
I was just going to say that it is a pretty interesting question of whether insurance companies should and can own physicians and hospitals. Heather, you were just describing, it seems like there'd be a conflict of interest there. Some have argued that. We do have a Department of Justice that checks that carefully. There have been many studies that have come out that describe how there can be tremendous efficiencies with that as well, where the insurance company is, in fact, smoothing out systems to connect, because they have an interest in keeping costs down, smoothing out systems between physicians, hospitals, and what they need to care for patients. I think the big question is whether they are in a competitive market with another insurance company that owns physicians and hospitals as well. If there's no competition in the market and the insurance company owns physicians and hospitals, then you've got a problem, I think.
Tracy says on Twitter, spending more on premiums than rent and mortgage is unjust. Perhaps framing health care as a national investment would be a good start, which I think both of you said at the beginning of the conversation. And Joe says, I see health insurance as a way to budget health costs over my lifetime and hope it will work that way as I age and need it more. To the phones to Zach in Hopkins. Hi, Zach. What's your experience with this?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
So recently, my wife and I had a child in May, but previously in last January, when open season was available, as I'm a government employee,
mm-hmm.
We learned that Blue Cross didn't have a deal with our provider, so we didn't feel comfortable switching our provider based on the fact that our health insurance didn't have a deal with them.
Uh-huh.
So we changed insurance, fortunately, and found one that did. However, now we are in that insurance, which worked out well, which was health partners. And now it turns out that I have a knee injury, and it's a $900. If I paid it myself, it's $900 for the MRI to see if I need surgery. But I also have about $1,000 left on my deductible.
So, Zach,
so we're just punting and waiting until January and seeing if it gets better or if I still need surgery then.
So just the takeaway here sounds like, for me, it's the agreements that your health insurance plan has with specific hospitals may not fit some of the choices that you want to make and actually may end up being more expensive to you. Is that right?
Yeah, and how your life situation changes unforeseeably, and then you're kind of stuck with the plan you have.
That's a
at
good
least
point.
For another year.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You may not be able to work. I mean, fortunately for me, my leg is a little better. I just deal with the pain.
Uh-huh.
But,
yeah.
It's just like, you know.
Renee,
you're over a barrel.
Yeah, Renee, this is a good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, no, and this is something that happens more and more, where the insurance companies will have a specific network of doctors that they'll allow you to go to. When you're looking at maintaining cost and improving people's healthcare outcomes, one of the most important things you can do is have people have a consistent primary care provider. Mm-hmm. And what this gentleman's talking about is he had to make a choice to stay with his primary care provider or the provider they wanted, and they had to make a choice with the health insurance they were looking at.
I want to make sure I understand why the difference, where the difference is in having a consistent primary care provider. Why does that matter?
Well, and Elizabeth probably will back me up. If you want to just look at the outcomes, the way it tends to work is there after 3 to 5 years of continuity, there's a significant improvement in healthcare outcomes. And I, as someone who teaches family medicine and teaches at the medical school, the way we sort of look at it is when you have a complete understanding of someone's, you know, biopsychosocial.
Okay.
You're looking at them as a whole person. I look at my patients within their entire family. I've known them. A lot of these kids I've delivered, and I take care of their grandparents. I see them as a fully functional being
mm-hmm.
in their community. And when I address them, when I make choices with them, and I help them make their choices about their healthcare, we work together as a team. That actually has improved outcomes. It's really, they call it the primary care paradox. It's sort of interesting. If you look at the numbers for primary care docs who take care of diabetics, our numbers may not be as good, but our actual long-term healthcare outcomes are better. And so you're in the situation
yeah.
where it's about building the relationship, and it's about understanding where the patient's coming from mm-hmm. and helping them make their life choices and trying to work with their values, seeing them as a person, not just a bunch of numbers.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, I would really like to back that up. As the caller, Zach, had just described, you know, I've got this MRI I have to go to, and I don't really know this doctor, and gee, I wonder if my knee will just get better. We know from so much, and Renee has quoted this primary healthcare paradox, which is terrific. We know from so much literature that really looking at a lot of different inputs to make someone healthy matters, not just MRIs, not just surgery, not just the medical care system, but, you know, what people are eating, how they're exercising, what's their job like, how are they managing themselves? And in some ways, we have this funny system in the U.S. where we've built up such an intensive, high-technology medical care system, and people have insurance, so it's the first place we turn. And, you know, some providers, of course, especially those who might not know you as well, think, I just want to help you. Go get an MRI, and we'll see what happens. But, in fact, a primary care physician can look at your whole life and look at even your financial goals and say, well, actually, there are like three different things you could do here. One of them could be an MRI, but there are all these other things that you might be able to do to mitigate the problems. And ultimately, you might have a healthier, that is a holistic view on health, a healthier life that uses less medical care, is less expensive to you, but actually allows you still to function well. And this, I think, is a point that really hasn't been in our healthcare debate enough. We're talking so much about how to finance medical care.
Right.
But medical care is just one input into health. All these other pieces of a person's life are really fundamental to conferring health.
I wanted you both to hear a little bit of a conversation that we had during the single-payer discussion last week. Dr. Arkell Georgiou was with us, and then Professor Jerry Kaminsky from UCLA. And they got into a debate about behavior, health consumer behavior, and how that fits in with the idea of what you're responsible for when it comes to healthcare costs. So listen to this.
I just don't want us to think that we're going to be able to, by being more informed consumers and more engaged in promoting our health, be able to live a disease-free life.
Jerry Arkell has to come back on this.
I've just been waiting. Jerry, I respect you greatly, but that is a politically correct answer. I fundamentally disagree that people's health is not in their control.
I'm sorry, I thought we had more to that, but Elizabeth, what do you think of that?
It's a big question. In fact, I think that we have got to understand what are the contributors and determinants of health. One piece of it is medical care. One piece of it is your own behavior. But one piece of it is definitely the social context in which you live. Even as simple a thing as smoking, we might say that is an individual decision and it's all up to the individual, and if they smoke, that's their problem. And yet the cutting-edge research on this demonstrates very clearly if people around you smoke, you're more likely to smoke. And so it is socially even that behavior, which seems so individualistic, is very much, there's a social component to it. This ties back to the question, I think, that we started with about taking full responsibility for our medical care costs as a society.
Right.
A lot of our health outcomes really have to do with socially determined elements of our world and thereby having a clear responsibility as a society for providing insurance really to all, I think, is fundamental.
And Renee, I have about a minute left, but I think that is where you started with, you have to be aware in which environment you're making these decisions.
Yeah, it's the whole idea, you know, it's where you live, learn, work, and play that has the greatest impact on your overall health. When we're talking about cost sharing, we need to start impacting those areas. We need to start thinking about education. We need to start thinking about the fact that for my patients, I can tell how good their diabetes is in control by whether or not they have a house this month.
Really?
Yeah. I can tell by looking at their glucose meter whether or not they've been in a stable housing. So it's those kinds of things that have the long-term impact that are really where we need to think about cost sharing. If we want to address our national health issues, we need to say where we live, learn, work, and play is a critical part of that cost sharing. We need to make it fair for everybody, and we need to move forward.
Really good to have you back on in the studio and discussing healthcare. Renee, thank you. Elizabeth, thank you so much. Really good to have you on the show. Hope you'll come back.
Certainly will. Thank you.
Elizabeth Bradley with us, the author of The American Healthcare Paradox, and Renee Critchlow, University of Minnesota School of Health, an assistant professor and a primary care physician.